Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. 087 1400 106 is our WhatsApp number. It is time for Movies and Booze, or, well, booze anyway. Fionnuala Jones, Gene Smullen and Olivia Fahey are with us once again. Good afternoon to you all.
Hello.
Hi,
we are, yeah. You've heroic actions on Olivia Fahey's part, it must be said.
You've really
pulled it out of...
Nowhere, yes.
This is a very quiet week because, basically no one wanted to be stuck in the middle between The Odyssey and Spider-Man, which is out next week. So
This is literally a lull in the programming. Yeah, the calm before the storm. But, like, in terms of titles, though, The Curse of Love Island could be potentially a brilliant film.
Yeah.
That they, you know, there was some old Aztec inscription that they ignored. They Love Islanders, and then all their bikinis fell off or something terrible happened.
They end up in the caves of Drac and realised it was Dracula's cave or something like that.
But it's a documentary, isn't it?
It's a documentary about the series Love Island. It's coming to Prime Video, and it basically talks us through, you know, there's been a couple of very high profile deaths related to the show, and not necessarily that they happened on the show, but there are contestants and of course the host who have all died. And what I didn't realise is that they actually died a year between one another. So Sophie passed away in 2018, Mike in 2019, and then Caroline Flack in 2020.
Right.
And that's a lot in a very short period of time when the show had only really been on for 5 years again at that point. So, they're kind of diving into that.
And when they say it's a curse, do they mean like a supernatural curse, or maybe, you know, the way people are treated on these kind of shows might be the expectation aspect of it?
Yeah, it's more the latter. So people sort of think that they're going to become famous and then that's going to be their life forever. Whereas each year, the contestants, they only have like a year of a shelf life, or back when there was like the winter version, it was only 6 months of a shelf life, really, of popularity. So it's kind of more talking about how everybody is dealing with that and how essentially there wasn't as much duty of care to the contestants on how to cope with the aftermath of that.
Right. OK. Which I suppose is timely, given that, you know,
it's just about to finish up the
next
season.
Are you watching Love Island is a common question. And The Furious, this is just lads beating the tar out of each other. Would that be...
Quite literally. Like, it's from the producers of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but it doesn't have any of the kind of beauty of it. It's very dark. It's dreary. It's about child trafficking. The lead is a guy...
Gene was just probably on some. Oh no, it's not. No. Not my kind of thing, then. No.
It's actually quite a tough watch, and not just because it's in English and Chinese, but it's also just, you know, in terms of, like, the opening scene is a journalist who's trying to rescue a child from this child trafficking gang, and he gets literally speared with an arrow as she's trying to help him escape, and it's like harrowing.
Oh, God. Okay, right. So that's not a recurring character in the film.
No, right, okay. Definitely not.
At the end of that. Right, okay then.
What we have is a new Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand.
Okay.
To be honest with you, everybody says, oh, do we really need a new Sauvignon? That is what people are drinking.
My question is, is it even possible to produce a new Sauvignon?
Yeah, and actually the girl Fleur McCree, who produces this, she launched in 2011 a wonderful wine called Little Beauty, right? And it had a bit of a cult following. Mm. And this is her new wine, which is Pure Island, and it's very sustainable and it's got all the credentials in terms of its... green. It's like, you know, New Zealand are very, very strong on the whole sustainability thing. And that's something that she's emphasizing in this wine. But then we also have another white. And the second white is another new wine. And it's a Pinot Gris from Alsace. And quite frankly, I tried this about a week ago and I was blown away by it. I thought, oh, my God, this is an amazing wine. So I went back to Lynn Coyle, who's the buyer in O'Brien's, and said, can I get another bottle from you? Because I really want to feature this on News Talk because it's a stunner. It's an Alsatian Pinot Gris made by a girl called Sophie Scal, and it's absolutely wonderful.
Okay, Sophie Scal. Right, so what was wrong with the poster for La La Land, Fionnuala?
Okay, there was a wonky hand or something. Okay, so La La Land celebrating its 10-year anniversary, film starring Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, two aspiring aspiring somebody's chasing their dreams in Hollywood, and they're falling in love as the process continues. Directed by Damien Chazelle, celebrating 10 years, so they're re-releasing it to certain theatres. I haven't seen any screenings listed for Ireland yet, but I'd imagine that's coming because it's a hugely popular film. Anyway, the original poster from Lionsgate, they're dancing and they're singing in the film. That's not like a spoiler, but the poster is a still of them dancing together, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. And Ryan Gosling has said like that basically this poster haunts his dreams, because while they're dancing, Emma decided — this is hard because radio is obviously not a visual medium, so you're going to have to — I'm holding her hands, dear listeners. Emma's hand is up straight, right? Yeah. Ryan decided to put his hand flat as opposed to being also out straight. And he is on record as saying this like literally haunts his dreams, as that they were on set and people tried to say, this doesn't look cool. You look completely different to what Emma is doing. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, why would you not be doing the exact same motion, whatever? Says he'd literally love to do the role again as a result of this. So with this 10 year anniversary, Lionsgate said, okay, you know what? We'll Photoshop your hand. We're going to put it up straight. So now the hand's up straight, but now people are saying this doesn't honour the legacy of the film. Bring back Ryan Gosling's limp wrist immediately.
Well, I share their outrage.
You know? So,
wow.
We really are.
That's really
a season
now.
Oh my God. No films.
If you were to wade into this online
gene. Ryan Gosling's hand.
People are mad. People are very mad. So.
Yeah, that's in the I'm sorry I asked kind of category there. Why didn't at the time did they just say straighten your hand and take the picture again?
I don't really know. I don't know.
Like all the millions they have in Hollywood, nobody thought of doing that.
Oh, literally. If it's a still from it, then that was the scene where they're trying to catch the sunset. So I bet they only had like a certain number of takes, and then they're like, we just never did it, so we're screwed.
And weren't they shutting down actual roads as well? So it was like probably a nightmare traffic-wise and time-wise and everything. They probably were very limited in what they could do.
Yeah, probably they were trying to catch that sunset, wasn't it?
But again, then also I'm like, for the poster, would you've not? We had Photoshop 10 years ago.
We did.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
we could have probably
absolutely
done something then, but...
Yeah. Just quietly Photoshop it, say nothing else about it.
Yeah.
But then they wouldn't have had that, so they could do it 10 years later for the anniversary.
And we wouldn't be talking about it here
and
now.
They get radio stations around the world to talk about this nonsense.
Yeah,
no. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the morning show will be ending next season.
Kind of in a surprise to no one. Like, yeah. like is it shocking news? I suppose it's shocking in the sense that The Morning Show was kind of one of the first Apple TV scripted original series, and gave the 2-season order in 2017, even before like The Streamer had launched, and was obviously a massive deal considering the star power. You're talking about Jennifer Aniston, you're talking about Reese Witherspoon, but I think it has kind of like run its course. What started is they've kind of had to change their tact in terms of what they've been covering, and obviously what the show started as has become very different. You were looking at like sexual assault allegations within a newsroom that was kind of art imitating life, imitating art, etc., etc. Last season they were trying to do kind of stuff with AI and, you know, like media mogul tycoons, and how does the little guy come up against them. There was lots of speculation that whether Aniston and Reese Witherspoon were even like filming together, because they were kept — their characters seemed to be kept so far apart and having these kind of very separate storylines. No idea what this next season is going to cover. Aniston and Witherspoon are obviously back. Then we also have Billy Crudup, who's been in the series previously, Mark Duplass, Karen Pittman, and then John Hamm. And we have new additions: Jeff Daniels, Renee Rapp, Jesse Williams, Sean Hayes, Lizzie Kaplan, and more to be revealed.
Crikey, they're not skimping money on cast.
No, it's still very starry. It's still something that people want to be involved in for whatever reason. So
Is this a Witherspoon production, or is she just a jobbing actor in this one?
I think she is involved in some capacity. Yeah. I think they're exec producers anyway. I'm not sure if that was the case from the very start, but definitely they're on board as execs now.
Well, you know all the kind of things she makes of — it's always like five women murder someone.
I don't know if it's Hello
shows.
I don't know if it's a Hello Sunshine production, but I am open to correction on that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Look, I don't really know where else they could have taken it. Even like Greta Lee left last season, and like she was really good kind of amongst the — but look, I think once you take it as — it's not necessarily prestige drama, it's kind of soapy, ludicrous, and they have loads of money and it looks great. Like, whatever, like it's fun. So
yeah. Okay, yeah. Though even at that, you can push it a bit too far. You can, you know, even if you're watching and you know it's just chewing gum
years,
you go, for God's sake.
Look, I mean, at one point people were in space, you know, like, you know, so like...
That was my point.
There's a lot going on.
You've not only jumped the shark, you've blasted it into outer space.
Truly.
Let's talk about our first wine today, Jane.
Okay, so we have our Pure Island Sauvignon Blanc. Now, The thing about New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, this is from Marlborough, it's a taste profile that people just love. And part of the reason is they use a specific yeast, right, to give you that lovely sweetness. Like, you know, this is a wine style that has been created and literally first started in 1986 when Kevin Judd put New Zealand on the map with Cloudy Bay, right? Yeah. And so fast forward 40 years. Oh, my God. 40 years. Jesus.
Is it that long ago?
Yeah, 86 oh my God. To 2026 is 40. Crikey. Oh, God, I'm getting old. But anyway, but it's still going and it's still going strong. Now, I mean, what you stick your nose in there and you're getting all that lovely kind of, you know, tomato leaf and the really kind of aromatic that you expect from New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And then when you try it, there's that lovely sweet fruit, but there's that acidity. That's why everybody loves it. People who like acidic wines love New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Now,
are they all made in Marlborough, Jean?
No, the Sauvignon Blanc in Nelson, the Sauvignon Blanc up in the North Island as well. But it's the Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc is the one that's really caught on. And I mean, the two wine regions in the world that where man's intervention actually made the greatest wine region are the Omadoc in Bordeaux and Marlborough in New Zealand. And why? Because in the Omadoc was originally up until the Napoleon's time was a big marshland. And after the French Revolution, they drained the land, and what they found was this wonderful gravel soil, and so they planted grapes on it, and it produced some of the greatest reds in the world. And Marlborough is the same. They built the town of Blenheim, and they redirected the river, which because this was the bottom of a glacial lake, you know, in prehistoric times, and they redirected the river, and then what they found was all this wonderful soil, and they planted Sauvignon Blanc on it. And the gas thing, I remember I visited there in 2011, and we were flying into Marlborough on one of these little tiny planes, and I am not the greatest flyer in the world, I can tell you.
But you know you're flying on one of those
planes. And there was an elderly couple sitting beside me, they were practically holding my hand, right? And when we were coming in over Marlborough, I went, oh my God, the whole place is covered in vines. I said, I wasn't expecting. And she said, I remember when it was sheep and apple trees and I wanted back. Literally, that's what she said. And that was it. And so Marlborough is max now. There's nowhere else. And so they're planting over in Attaware and further down, like calling it kind of Marlborough, but it's not really. Marlborough has reached peak plantation. There's nowhere else you could plant in there. But it's if the area was bigger and they could produce more wines from the region, they would sell them because it is one of the most in demand wines.
Does that make it more difficult then to come up with some sort of variety?
Yeah, and now you've got like the Chinese are after the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc for Marlborough. Everybody's after New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. We're very lucky. We get a very good allocation of it to this country, right? And it's great to see. For me, it's great to see another New Zealand Pure Island. This is exclusive to Dunn Stores. They literally just launched it in the early July, and it's on an offer at the moment. It's on an offer price at the moment, but that's going to go gangbusters. That will, you know, Pure Island people will be going in. They'll be buying it. Why? Because they like it.
Okay, fair.
I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's why people love New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, because they love the style.
Wondering if your wine guru has enjoyed a glass of Echo Falls Blue Raspberry wine.
No.
Sounds vile.
Blue raspberry wine.
Yeah. Maybe that's the name of it. But I don't know.
No, I haven't. But I'll keep an eye out for it. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
I think we'll all be keeping an eye for it.
I'm intrigued now.
Under the definition, wine has to be made from the crushed grape juice. So but raspberries don't come into it.
Yeah,
can't call it wine if there's raspberries.
Blue raspberries as well.
Yeah, I didn't know there was. Have you ever seen a blue raspberry?
No, not that I know of. No.
I thought it was literally.
And speaking of raspberries, this year I decided to be in my new garden, right? I bought 4 raspberry plants, right? Mm-hmm. The return was abysmal. It cost me nearly €50. And by the time I'd fed them and done everything, I think I got half a punnet.
It was probably the summer. But they're still alive, aren't they?
Oh, they are.
Well, then next year you'll go gangbusters.
I hope so. Anyway.
Got to have faith.
Yeah.
Anyway, Olivia, which movie would you like to do first? But let's do The Furious. I'll tell you why. Because we don't have a clip of the other one. We'll be reviewing The Furious after this. tender and moving scene from The Furious, the next film that Olivia's going to tell us about. Is this available on a streamer?
No,
it goes on like that for 2 hours.
So it was released in cinemas in China, but it actually didn't come out in cinemas over here. It just went straight to like paid video on demand, PVOD, right, as we call it. If you're interested in renting something that's a bit kung fu-y, then that's what we've got.
It is. And can everybody do kung fu in this film?
Pretty much. Even the guy who, so the lead character is called Wang Wei, and he is a mute who has moved to Hong Kong with his daughter, but then because there's a rise in child trafficking, he's trying to get her back to China. She doesn't want to go without him, runs away in a huff, and guess what? Gets kidnapped by child traffickers. And so it's about him trying to go and find her. But the kicker is that he's mute. So he actually doesn't speak throughout the entire film, and he's trying to get help by writing on like post-it notes to explain to people what has happened and to try and get some help, whereas they're just kind of looking at him. He's like covered in blood after trying to fight off her attackers and all this, and he's in the police station just covered in blood, and they're just like, no dude, if you want to make a report you got to go over there, and he's just looking at them being like, just help me, for crying out loud.
I'm covered in blood.
He realises very quickly, and it's a great bit of foreshadowing because he just sort of looks around and he's like, okay, I don't think they're going to help me. They keep saying, it's like, we have protocols to follow and da da da. But then he turns around, he just sees this wall of missing children's posters. Mm. And then you kind of realise, oh, they're probably not going to do anything about this.
Oh my gosh. So he has to take matters into his own hands.
Exactly.
And that's actually a unique twist in a film. You never see that kind of thing.
Never. It's so rare. Yeah. And he actually befriends this guy who is looking for his wife, who I mentioned, she's at the beginning of the film, she's a journalist, and she goes missing after that opening sequence, presumed dead, and he's trying to basically find her, and they end up encountering each other during this actually very good in terms of like fight choreography and entertainment wise. It's in this like nightclub MMA fight kind of sequence, so not only are they fighting through the nightclub, they also then end up in the octagon fighting off all of the bad guys kind of thing, and it's really well done in that sense. But in terms of storyline and plot, dear God, it would never end. It's just shy of 2 hours, and there were at least 4 points where it could have ended perfectly, and it just didn't. It just kept going on and on and on.
Is this a bit so in the, that kind of structural sense? Is it like a kind of a Marvel movie where it's a half an hour too long because they need a big choreographed fight sequence at the end?
Not even. Like, yes, there is that big choreographed fight sequence, but there's actually several of them that you could have then counted as, oh, that's the big end fight sequence. And then you're like, oh, they're back in the, oh, they're doing this now. Oh, okay, now they're over here now. Oh, there's another group coming towards the building. And it's just like, it just really and truly didn't know where to stop. It was like, oh, we have like a time that we need to hit, so we're just going to keep going until we reach it. Pretty much. Because even like, there was a moment after about like an hour and I was like, oh, well, the child is rescued now. Oh, no, she's not.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, they somehow got her out of the basement that has no other exit other than the one that they went down. Just suddenly the children just weren't there. No, yeah, it just kept going. It was in like a never-ending onslaught of fight sequences and like some humour for sure, it wasn't funny as maybe like in points where it wasn't like supposed to be funny. You just couldn't help but have a little giggle.
Oh,
like
God.
He gets hit by a car chasing down the van that has kidnapped the daughter, and because of whatever effect they used, the body ends up flipping over in like a really kind of like jolty kind of effect, so it just looks really weird. So he gets hit by the car and you can't help but laugh because it just looks so humorous, but clearly that was not the reaction they were looking for.
Right, okay. And is it aiming to be kind of a gritty, you know, because it deals with a pretty serious issue?
Yeah, it is. And even like with the colour tone and the cinematography and things like that, it all looks quite dark and gritty and all this type of stuff. I think it's like almost trying to be kind of like The Raid or Judge Dredd kind of vibe, but failing epically at that. Because it just doesn't really capture the same kind of, because they're moving to different places, so it's not really encapsulating the whole you're stuck in a room and you have to fight your way out kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is you're entering a room and then trying to fight to get somebody out, but then you just keep entering all these other rooms where there's more bad guys, and then you're fighting your way through kind of all these different areas.
It does sound like a game, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe it was structured that way deliberately.
It could have been. Who knows?
Did this have a gimp of a film that was made for like a tenner kind of thing? Are they churning this crap out?
It honestly looked like it. And what made it even funnier is that like I was watching it going, God, the journalist guy looks really, really familiar. And then I realised he played Sub-Zero in the Mortal Kombat movie. And I'm like, oh, well, clearly this guy has a type of film. film, because I believe when I reviewed that here a couple of weeks ago, I said it's literally just all about the fighting. You don't really need the plot. And that's kind of exactly what this film is. Yes, they tried to infiltrate the fighting movie with some sort of plot, but at the end of the day, anything that came out of it that I said was good was all the fight choreography.
And it's in Chinese and English.
Yeah, so what's funny is that it's the grown-ups are all speaking English, but it's the children that are speaking in Chinese.
Right.
So it's kind of that little like separation. Yeah. And so it's not all the time, but it's like when you do see like him and the daughter. Now, he's not replying to her, of course, but the daughter's always speaking to him in Chinese before she's kidnapped and stuff like that. So I was like, that's actually an interesting dynamic to have.
Yeah.
But yeah, everybody else is speaking in English.
Yeah. So obviously they're pitching this to an an English speaking audience as well.
Yeah. Clearly. So I think it was Lionsgate who had helped like produce it, but then they kind of fobbed it off to one of their subdivisions for distribution. And I don't know whether it hit the cinemas in the US, but it certainly didn't hit them over here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. If you like fighting, basically, as well. Yeah, it's an old-fashioned kind of Bruce Lee type movie.
Kind of, yeah. And if you're just sort of looking to get some rage out in between, you know, two good cinema weeks, you know, you sit at home and rent it to watch at home.
Yeah. Right, so there's going to be a Snoop Dogg biopic.
Yes.
Which won't have Kung Fu in it.
Yeah, well,
one assumes.
You never know.
You never know.
We talked about this a few weeks ago when we talked about the success of Michael, the Michael Jackson biopic from Universal Pictures, and how basically I'm pretty sure it's the most financially successful musical biopic of all time. So now Universal are like, okay, what other artists and what else can we look at? Now this has been in the works a while, so this isn't necessarily off the back of that, but it seems to be kind of their next big tentpole. Now, no idea in terms of like how much or how little of his life is being covered, but it is coming out next August, August 6th, 2027. Jonathan Davis is going to play Snoop Dogg. People will know him from Outer Banks. It's written by Craig Brewer, who worked on Songs on Blue most recently in Hustle and Flow. And obviously Universal have kind of a reputation as well, or, you know, they've done pretty well in terms of other hip hop biopics previously. Like Straight Outta Compton in 2015 was Oscar nominated, made a load at the box office. In that, funnily enough, Lakeith Stanfield was actually playing Snoop, which I thought was interesting, but I suppose Lakeith is now probably a bit too old if they're looking at kind of, which I'd imagine they are, because that's the most interesting part of any artist's tale, is like, how do you go from a nobody to a somebody, you know, that way. And Lakeith is at this point too old, whereas Jonathan Davis is a little bit younger. So yeah, one to watch out for next year.
Yeah. But they haven't said, is there a particular period of his life that they're covering? And was there anything, did Snoop do time in prison or anything particularly kind of gritty?
I mean, like, there's lots of interesting angles. You could, like, him being best friends with Martha Stewart. Like, I would like to see that. Like, who's going to play Martha Stewart in the film? I don't know if they're going to focus on that particularly. Yeah. I think I need to seek out a different film for that.
Is it just going
to
be like 2 hours of watching a guy stoned out of his gourd all the time?
No, I think it is.
Sponsoring things.
Like, the way they keep describing it as his, quote, eventful path to fame. So, like, but he is the kind of person that I think maybe, like, there could be as much comedy as there is drama.
I would have thought so, yeah.
In the kind of road to getting to be Snoop Dogg, you know?
He was part of the Tupac Biggie Smalls kind of bubble as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So I think that'll be in it.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd be surprised if it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but was he in the periphery of it, or was he kind of really...
He was on the West Coast side of the argument, for sure.
Yeah. It's kind of weird, though, they're making biopics of people who are still alive, and it's almost like those people are getting younger and younger, and so, like, you know, they'll be...
Yeah, because
biopic of Timothy Chalamet, played by Timothy Chalamet.
Oh my God, don't wish that into existence. Yeah, I suppose he is only 54, and he's also a producer on this. So, like, again, you're getting a very specific version of this story as well, you know?
Yeah, you're not going to be getting the,
warts and all. Like,
warts and all. Only the warts.
But then you won't get it. No one will sign off on a warts and all biopic, you know, that way. So.
No, because he could sue. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's also that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. We will take a break. We'll follow this up with more movies and booze. And of course, we'll be giving away some money. I did read out a text a little while ago from somebody wondering about Echo Falls Blue Raspberry Wine. It is a real thing.
Yeah.
It's what they call a fruit fusion wine. Now, it's a low alcohol thing and tastes mostly of whatever fruit they put in it. So, yeah.
Yeah, technically it can't be called wine, but yeah. It's aimed at the younger audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
How young?
Yeah. Well, you have to be over 18 to consume alcohol.
One would ask that question.
Now, this is the first thing, like, we're on radio, obviously, but do you notice how dark, much darker this this wine is? That's because it's been aged in wood. This is absolutely gorgeous. It's an organic Pinot Gris from Alsace. Sophie Schall is the name of the producer. It's 2024 is the vintage. It's available in O'Brien's. It's one of their new wines. They've started to bring in some new wines, and they sent me out Hampton Water as well, which is John Bon Jovi's. Very good.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I look at these things a bit skeptical. But it was actually really good.
But the guy he makes, the actual winemaker, his name sounds a bit like John Bon Jovi as well.
And he's nice. And his wine is nice as well. So you'll get that in O'Brien's as well. But this blew me away. I mean, I love Pinot Gris, right? Or Pinot Grigio, as it's known. The Italian pseudonym for it is Pinot Grigio. Pinot Gris is a pink grape, right? It's kind of mutated over the years, right? And so it tends to have a kind of a pinkish tinge to it sometimes. It's a kind of a cross between Pinot Noir and a sort of a Traminer grape from Central Europe. You know, that's where it evolved. But in Alsace, it's just a rock star grape. It really, really is. So the thing about Pinot Gris as a grape is that it's got loads of depth and character and a really kind of textured mouthfeel. And then the wood age, I mean, when you stick your nose in there, the first thing you get is that sort of spiciness. But Pinot Gris as a grape variety has a spicy character anyway. You know, I mean, that's kind of part of the actual grape. I just think this has enormous complexity. It's, you know, this is a really, really good wine. This is the sort of wine that I would sit down on a nice summer evening and just sip away, maybe a little bit of cheese, some charcuterie, you know, just in the back garden. Or if I don't get eaten alive by I've been bitten twice by insects this summer, both times cellulitis kicked in. So it's been very expensive summer from that point of view. So I'll sit with the legs covered.
Sit outside, weeping over your raspberry bush.
weeping over my raspberry bush. Yeah. But look, it doesn't get any better than this. You know, it's a darker colour. You smell it. And Pinot Gris as a grape, you know, the aromatics of Pinot tend to be quite neutral. They, you know, it's kind of sort of wet wool, they say. But, you know, there isn't a huge amount coming out of, apart from the wood coming out of the nose of this. But when you try it, God, that's gorgeous. There's lovely complexity. You get this beautiful tropical fruit. There's that lovely spiciness coming through. It's not very acidic, but there's a kind of a rounded mouthfeel to it. That I could just sit and sip that all day. Yeah, I think that is just yummy.
And sometimes your Pinot Grigio can be a bit bland.
Italians don't want their white wines to have any sort of depth of flavour, colour or anything. So they cold ferment everything so that it's all terribly neutral.
Yeah.
So your Italian Pinot Grigio is made that way because the Italians like kind of neutral white wines. This is from France. This is Alsace. This is up in northern France,
it's
right?
Almost Germany.
In the lee of the Vosges Mountains. Mm. And where primarily they grow white wine, and it's cool climate. It's north of Paris, so it's, you know, it's a cold climate, and they make the most beautiful white wines in that area, and this is one of them. So Sophie Schall, Schaal, her organic Pinot Gris in O'Brien's, definitely worth a try.
Sophie Schall is great. Is that her real name?
That's her real name.
Schall.
Yeah, she was born. She's made born in Burgundy. That's just her surname. You know, pronouncing it wrong.
Sophie,
you know,
Schall.
Anyway, Sophie Schall.
Well, in France, in French, it probably sounds completely different.
Yeah, probably does.
I would have thought. So in a mad burst of creativity, they're going to make a TV series out of RoboCop.
They sure are, for Prime Video, which is planning on tackling corporate greed.
Yeah.
At Prime Video.
Should they not do a documentary on irony and how to understand it?
They should. Anyway, look, this is coming to Prime Video at some stage. It's coming from Blumhouse, which that kind of makes me more intrigued, because like what Blumhouse does with like kind of horror and thrillery kind of stuff, I think would be intriguing. And this is going to be 8 episodes. It's coming from Peter Ocko as the showrunner. I didn't realise this. The original RoboCop film from 1987, I didn't realise it was directed by Paul Verhoeven, who also did Showgirls. girls. Yeah, that's range. Yeah. Girls, that's range. I'll tell you that. Obviously, at that instance of RoboCop followed the story of a crime ridden Detroit. There's a police officer. He's rebuilt as this mechanical superhero, and it was seen as this very satirical take on corporate America. But as you hinted at there, they have tried to do this loads of times. Like, even as much as we talk about reboots and stuff on this show, like, this is a crazy amount of times they've tried to do this. So they did a 12 episode animated TV series from Marvel in 1998. Then they did two sequel films. One was 1990's RoboCop 2, the very original title, and 1993's RoboCop 3, would you believe?
Oh, wow.
Then in 1994 there was a very short lived RoboCop TV series, and then in 2001 there was a live action miniseries called RoboCop Prime Directives, and then 2014 there was a reboot as well, starring Joel Kinnaman. So they just said, if at first you don't succeed,
keep copying.
Just yourself up and try again.
And actually, it was an Irish actor. Was Dan O'Hurley? He was the baddie. He was the bad corporate baddie.
Yeah.
And that was actually a great film. You know, I really liked that. It's a lifetime ago.
God, I must say that Joel Kinnaman,
I was doing my research on this, the research is like, oh, that's probably the best known reboot. I was like, is it? Maybe not. Maybe more in the US, but like I had no awareness of that at all. I thought it was at least the 90s since they'd had a crack at this. So I was like, okay, fair enough, like, do it again. But when you have a show as recently as 2014, I'm like, is the writing not on the wall with this, that people are not interested in this? I don't know.
You see, the story arc in the original RoboCop was quite strong in that, you know, it was a crime-ridden Detroit, but then, and he's kind of reprogrammed, but then his memories come back, sort of thing. And he's trying to regain some degree of his humanity. And so he's fighting against the system that literally created him.
Mm.
But you can't probably do that if it's a series, and unless it's going to be just one series where you get that story arc. And if they're going to have series 2, 3, 4, 5, how does
that
work?
Which they want.
What does he do? Is he like hiding and you can't see RoboCop anywhere and he jumps out again?
Maybe.
Goes, boom. You're under arrest.
Scary RoboCop, literally.
And there's no, Why can't they think of it? They must.
I know.
I wonder in Hollywood, are there like loads of completely, really, really bereft people who are coming up with original ideas and pitching them and banging their heads off a stone wall?
I'd say so, yeah. And I'd say in these rooms, it's honestly like spin a wheel of what existing property do we have that we haven't had a bash at in a while, or what existing property can we get that we can like build off of? And it's just spin the wheel, and it's RoboCop today, class. Now, again, this has been kicking around for a while and it's only been greenlit now, so.
Yeah. The reboot movie of RoboCop was as dull as dishwater, not a patch on the reboot of Dread. I can't remember the reboot of Dread either, to be honest. I remember this. Was it the Sylvester Stallone one was the original one?
Yeah, and then Carl Urban is the reboot one. Carl Urban one is very good.
All right, okay, I haven't seen that. Because I remember Sylvester going, I am the law! and the thing was, like, he probably that was his best enunciation, really. That's actually the best he could talk. Anyway, we'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is The Curse of Love Island. Here's a clip. No, we don't have one.
Straight into it.
So this is so lay it out, because it's quite, I suppose, disturbing, really, that the things that have happened to in this series.
Yeah, and I think, so for me personally, like, I am not a massive Love Island fan. And I think I've only watched like one or two episodes here and there back when I was working and I had to cover it for work, basically. So there's bits of this that I was aware of, bits that I knew, but actually going into the details and seeing it all kind of like laid out in front of you in a perfect kind of like timeline, it's actually quite interesting to kind of look at how these things all kind of went down and how the changes you could see happening over time. And it's just shy of 2 hours, and they literally take it season by season, and they're talking to former contestants, they're talking to reality TV agents, they're talking to producers, journalists, and all this type of stuff. And actually one of the talking heads is Orla Condon, who did My Pod on Paper, and she actually features quite a lot, which I think is great because she has such great like insights and kind of like expert analysis of like what was kind of going on at the time. And it even shows some clips from her podcast during the documentary as well, which I think someone in this room appears on as well. So I think I hear Fionnuala's voice in one of the clips as well.
I did not know. So that's fun to learn in real time.
Checks in the post.
Yeah.
Or not.
Surely if some of that RoboCop money.
So Fionnuala's voice can be heard on
I think it's Fionnuala's voice, yeah.
I was on that podcast, so.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. So you're in there. This is so weird.
I know, this is so meta.
We're reviewing a film that Fanula's in.
Yeah.
I have not seen the documentary, but I'm very intrigued.
But I want to, any listeners who are worried about that, if we think it's crap, we'll say so. Yeah. Whether Fanula's here or not. We won't be biased in our reviews. Anyway, continue. Yes. Fanula glares at you.
But it's just kind of interesting from someone kind of like on the outside who only has heard like passing like little snippets, especially like in the media, because you only really, without watching the show, you only kind of see the headlines. Mm. Whereas in this, you're kind of learning what was going on behind the headlines and things like that. So like the guy who was on season one, Lewis. He has been talking about how like, oh, like because they were on season one, they had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. And he was like, oh, like my family and like my grandmother were watching at home, as at one point all the lads had to take off their trousers and just stand there in their wife fronts and just basically be judged on how large their package was. Mm. And he was just like, it's kind of embarrassing to look back on these things, and it's like, how do you get away with that?
But it wasn't embarrassing then.
It was just like, it's like when you think back, it's like my granny saw that, and you know, like, yeah, how did they get away with that on TV? But that's just the type of show it is, and you kind of forget that you're on a show because you were just sort of there like living your life. And then you can kind of see how like over time it got so overly produced. And even Anton kind of passes that comment. He was in season 5 with Maura Higgins and that kind of era, which was massive. And then he went on to be in All Stars. And he was saying, going back for All Stars, he couldn't believe how different it was and how different it felt, because it was so overly produced and they were actively kind of putting you into like situations. And something that he said that I thought was really, really interesting is that he was like, oh, like as much as ITV have like put in like all of these like aftercare kind of tools and things like that, he's like, you can put all of these things on the front end to make it look like you're looking after people, but then you're putting them into all of these situations and letting them spiral. It's why I will never do reality TV again. And yeah, I was like, that's actually a really interesting way of looking at it, because as much as, yes, ITV are kind of like doing their best now to provide aftercare for the contestants and more kind of therapy and things like that, but at the same time, they're still kind of like pushing them into situations cause havoc.
And it's by its very nature exploitative. And exactly, you can't pretend, oh no, we won't exploit them, but we will.
Yeah, and Mullen was even talking about how she got dumped from the island before her partner was in season 2, and then he recoupled with someone, and she was sitting at home like basically watching the man who said that he was like in love with her basically start hooking up with somebody else the minute that the door was like hitting her on the way out, kind of thing. And they invited her back to go and confront him on camera. And she was like, yeah, that was
a crazy moment.
Yeah. And she was like, it was basically like just exploiting the whole situation. And you know, like, I was like deeply upset by the whole situation, and looking back now, I'm like, wow, they really just took advantage of me in a really kind of vulnerable state.
Yeah,
which is true.
Because it often strikes me, it's not like, a lot of people watch Love Island, but a lot of people don't. They look at bits of it on Instagram, and it's almost like it's a program that's been deliberately disassembled that way. So it's made up of a lot of 30 or a minute long reels. And it's those kind of moments that they want to put on Instagram. And there the Maura Higgins comes back to confront the guy who's now run off with somebody else, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which are the deliberately upsetting things.
Yeah. And actually, I didn't realise how big of a hand Twitter had in its kind of like rise to fame, because it was like after season one, a lot of the super fans then were taking to Twitter, and they were having like the kind of like watch along kind of like conversations. And then that introduced more people to the show. So then by the time season 3 actually hit, then it was like this absolutely massive thing. And again, just, I had no idea just the power of social media with the show in that sense. But then it also comes with the downside of, well, then everybody's kind of given out about the contestants. And if they don't like you, then they're saying all these horrible things, whether you're on the show or even after the show. And that was something that Mike in season 3 had to deal with. He was a bombshell that came in, and basically he was referred to by one of the lads as Muggy Mike. And he was really put off by that. And then that took off on Twitter. And when he came out, he was trying to kind of like capitalize on it a little bit and try and like make some money. He's like, well, if people are going to be calling me Muggy Mike, I might as well try and like make some money out of it. But then when he did actually like break up with someone who he really cared about, he was really upset. And everyone was just like, oh, that's just Muggy Mike again and all this. And he was like, oh, for crying out loud, I'm actually like deeply upset about this breakup. Leave me alone. So there was that kind of imbalance between like, you're trying to you know, capitalize on your fame, but then you're also being victimized as well.
Yeah, so. And is it? And does the documentary kind of go into all of that?
It does. Yeah. So the Sophie was in season two with Mullen. So Mullen is kind of like talking about their experiences and how, even though Sophie was like a strong, independent woman, she even sort of felt the need to kind of go under the knife and get some procedures done to try and like keep up with, you know, what the looks were at the time. Mullen did the same. And there's no direct reason to say why she decided to take her own life. But it is sort of linked with that there was no kind of like aftercare of like the come down of, you know, she wasn't as in demand afterwards.
You know,
the money was drying up and things like that. And that's kind of hinted at as well.
She was also like the first LGBTQ plus contestant, kind of, because she recoupled with a girl in this in the season. And that was kind of exploited and like played for drama. And I know her partner then also died by suicide like shortly after her own death. So
it was just
like loads of these. And again, like they'll say now that in terms of aftercare, it's like there's constant contact with the counsellor and the drink is managed and everything like that. But a lot of those people, especially when it was just, I think season three was like, it really, really started to take off and maybe peaked around season five. You're kind of sending these people into the show in which they can, you know, fornicate and do whatever else. And it's all shown, et cetera, et cetera. And none of them really had the tools afterwards then to kind of, how do I make a career out of this? Can I make a career out of this? What do I do if that's not the case? You know,
would anyone have the tools to deal with that afterwards?
But that's the thing. And a lot of these people, like, I think this is something they've pulled back on now, and they're still incredibly young. Don't get me wrong. Like they're still in the, like, mostly their early 20s, we'll say. But like sometimes they were letting people, like contestants as young as 18 or 19 go on, like fresh out of school. And it's like, and everyone thinks, like, as much as I talk about it and critique it and I watch the show and I'm like, I wouldn't have done that, blah, blah, blah. If I went in there, I wouldn't have a clue. And I wouldn't have a clue because they're so, at the end of the day, they're in control of the edit. You're even seeing it with this most recent season where, like, people, there's a hyper focus on some couples. And then I think they can tell when it gets too much and it's getting too negative and they try and put it on someone else. But as Olivia was kind of pointing to, and it sounds like the documentary is, the social ecosystem is a whole other thing where they're also trying to move a narrative. And at the end of the day, the producers can't control that, unfortunately, and there's such a manic subsection of that fandom that always take it too far.
I know, but they'd have a clue what way things would be going.
Exactly. And they'd like there is a thing of like, what are you showing? Are you showing people in a good light? And again, there's a whole thing of how do you condense a day's or 2 days' activities into an hour of television? But like, I think there's been some things where it's like, you haven't, you know, and again, they've been pulled up on things about like kind of exploitive edits and like edits that weren't like kind of fully telling the whole story. I know in season four, they sent back a clip of Jack Fincham meeting his ex-girlfriend, Danny Dyer, and they were in separate villas. So Danny Dyer didn't realise what was happening. She started bawling, crying, thinking they'd gotten together because that's what the edit made it look like had happened.
Oh.
But that wasn't the case at all. They got loads of Ofcom complaints that year because of it. So they've kind of pulled back on that because they know they can't get away with it now. But
what's funny is that they don't actually touch on that. But what they do say is with Marcel from season three, he was in Blazing Squad.
Yes.
And basically they had told him like on multiple times to be like, oh, go talk to that girl. Tell her you used to be in band. Oh, go talk to that girl. Tell her you used to be a band. So basically they then edit all these clips to be like, oh yeah, like I used to be in Blazing Squad. And they edited all those clips together to show like how often he was saying it. But actually he was being told to go and say it. But in the edit, it was just him looking like he was just always going on about being in Blazing Squad. So they even like were making t-shirts with that quote of him. So like that's not to the same extent as some of the other ones, but it does show just how even back in season three, they were kind of manipulating like what was going on. It's like the RuPaul song, Blame It on the Edit.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
That's so interesting. Actually, that does sound interesting.
It is,
It should be said.
Like it doesn't have like as many, I think like for someone like Fionnuala, who's a diehard fan, they probably don't have as many kind of like massive shock moments, but there are still a few that I found like, oh, okay, I definitely hadn't heard about that before. So I think it's definitely an interesting watch.
Yeah. Okay, that's
lovely note.
Thinking about that makes a reboot of RoboCop actually seem like a rosy prospect.
Warm and fuzzy RoboCop.
Thanks to Fionnuala, Jean and Olivia. That's our lot for today.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.